Hey, Swisspreneur listeners. Every year, Swisspreneur hosts three scale-up events for its community of founders and investors. In 2024, our first get-together will be the Scale-Up Slopes in the beautiful Locks on March 1st. Join us for a day of skiing or co-working among fellow entrepreneurs and VCs, followed by a flying dinner with a mountain view and a keynote speaker from a well-known Swiss scale-up. The event is open to all entrepreneurs interested in learning about the scale-up journey. Click the link in the show notes and apply to join before January 30th to get an early bird discount. We hope to see you there.
I can't talk about this idea to too many people because otherwise they will steal it. I mean, the idea is so precious. Worst thing you can do, you need to talk to everyone to validate the idea, to build a network, to find investors, to find potential employees, to find maybe co-founders, to find the right people who can help you pull that idea off.
Welcome to the Swisspreneur Show, a podcast about startup stories and learnings from experienced entrepreneurs. Here's your host, Sylvan.
Holger, a very well welcome to the Swisspreneur Show. It's a pleasure and an honor to have you here today.
Hey, Sylvan. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're the co-founder and CEO at Blinkist. I think almost every listener knows the app or has it used him or herself, the mobile first micro learning app. And before we talk about your journey from founding, validating, scaling, and then exiting your company, I actually want to start with your personal background. After your university, you worked for big companies like Volkswagen and Deutsche Telekom for just a couple of years before you then started Blinkist. Were you always dying to go your own way and build a startup?
Yes, absolutely. My passion for entrepreneurship got ignited when I was in school, thanks to a teacher who brought a lot of business. He brought a project to our school called Business at School, where that is all about understanding businesses, creating business plans, and eventually virtually starting your own company. And this project really taught me that I love this. I love starting something. I love being an entrepreneur. And since then, I always gravitated towards these ideas. Still, in university, I wanted to see the world, wanted to see different things. So did different internships that helped me to go abroad. Volkswagen was an internship actually in China. So I wanted to go to China and then found Volkswagen as a company that could get me there. During university, I found, like-minded people that also wanted to be entrepreneurs. We started a student consultancy together in our student town, and then frequently would brainstorm ideas, but did not have the idea that convinced us at the end of our studies. So I wasn't bold enough to just move to Berlin and say, well, let's find an idea. I went the classical route and applied for a proper job at a big company to continue to learn something, earn some money. And during that job, we continued to brainstorm and eventually had the idea that convinced us. And then it was a quick decision to quit the job and move to Berlin.
Amazing. What would have changed your mind? You finished university. What would have changed your mind to directly start your own company, or what was missing? Was it just sort of a lack with the leap of faith to take?
It was an idea that convinced me. I think I was raised rather conservatively, so maybe I wasn't crazy enough or bold enough to just say I'm not applying for a job, but I immerse myself in finding an idea to start a business. And that was 2010, so it was not, I think it was different times. The startup ecosystem in Germany was pretty nascent. There were some, Rocket Internet was around and some first startups, but it was not that, especially not where we were from in our university in the middle of Germany. It was not like, there were no role models that, just went to a city, say Berlin, then found an idea and then started a business. So I think due to the lack of role model, I was not daring enough. And this conservative, or not really conservative, but this normal, I was too normal maybe, and said like, okay, after university, you need a job. You need to earn money and you need to do something with your life. So yeah, so we all decided, you know, the my co-founders and I, the ones that I already was working with in university, we all decided to start a job. So I guess we wanted to become entrepreneurs, but we were not daring enough to just bet on it without even having an idea. We wanted that idea that convinced us before taking that leap of faith.
Sure. I think many people thinking about starting something, they might relate to that situation. They wait for the perfect idea or an idea at least good enough to convince them to start and jump.
I think that's important. I think if you wait for the perfect idea, you will never start. But we waited for a good enough idea that where we thought like that could actually work. I mean, no one knows whether it works. There are so many risks, et cetera. But yeah, we wanted a good enough idea that we felt it's a good fit for us, something we believed in, something we felt we could accomplish. We also had idea, you know, back then there was no dynamic ride sharing. In Germany, there was a thing called Mitfahrzentrale, where a website where you could, you know, in say like tomorrow I'll drive from Hamburg to Berlin and I have 3 seats left in my car. Who wants to join? So that was around, but nothing was dynamic. You know, no one talked about Uber or something else. So we also had an idea for a more dynamic ride sharing, but that later, you know, now there is BlaBlaCar, there's dynamic ride sharing and there's Uber, but we were not daring enough. We thought this idea is great and it will likely eventually come, but we did not feel we're capable enough of pulling it off. So it also, it needed, or we were looking for an idea that we felt like this is a good fit for us and we can get this, you know, we can succeed with this.
And talking about this idea that is good enough, what made it good enough for you to then be convinced that Blinkist was the right thing to focus on?
So we felt passionate about it. I mean, this is very subjective, but for us, Blinkist solved our own problem. So we felt there is a problem that we have and this would solve it. That made us passionate to say, like, this is something that we can resonate with. We are our own customers. Then we, you know, did some early prototypes and started to talk to our target group, basically, and got a lot of positive responses. A lot of people said, yeah, they have this problem. They would love to read more books, fit more learning into their life. They don't have the time. They don't have the motivation. So we had a pretty strong feeling there is a problem here that is worth solving. And then we just thought with the rise of smartphones back then, 2011, 2012, we thought new usage patterns will emerge and there will be new ways to solve such a problem. So we felt, yeah, it was a good fit for us because we were passionate about it, because a lot of customers or, you know, the people in our target audience gave us reassurance. And then I also started, I mean, back then I'd never talked to business angels or VCs. This was a whole new world to me. But then I asked my one of my bosses at Deutsche Telekom whether he knows people who are business angels. He introduced me to some people. Then we talked to business angels and they actually liked the idea. So we also got early confirmation from potential investors. So on these, you know, and confirmation from ourselves, from potential customers, from potential investors, then kind of build a perfect storm to say, like, let's, I mean, if we don't do it now, we will never do it. What are we waiting for?
Right. And I think that's exactly to what you said before. There's no perfect idea, but this validation, you started with solving your own problem. That's like the motivation part, right? You want to have a solution that you can use yourself, but then the feedback from your target group, from potential investors, that then sort of gave you the conviction that this idea is actually worth pursuing.
Yeah, absolutely. And back then, what we thought, and I still see some young entrepreneurs who have the same thinking, is I can't talk about this idea to too many people because otherwise they will steal it. And the idea is so precious. Worst thing you can do, you need to talk to everyone to validate the idea, to build the network, to find investors, to find potential employees, to find maybe co-founders, to find the right people who can help you pull that idea off. Because you know, and you can bet that if it's a good idea, there are other people in the world that have the same idea at the same time. So it always comes down to execution, who will dare to get started and who will execute well. And in order to execute well, you need to find the right people and you only find the right people and you need to get the right feedback to to tweak the idea in the right direction. And this only happens if you talk about it to everyone, literally everyone, whether they want to hear about it or not. You should talk about it, talk about it, talk about it. This is how we found our the fourth co-founder. We were three in the beginning who developed the idea and then needed a technical co-founder. And I just talked to everyone. And the sister of my wife, back then she was my girlfriend and our wife, her roommate was, a coder, someone who could code and was also interested in startups. And then she introduced us and that's how we met. And had I not talked about this idea at every family meeting, that connection may have never happened.
That's an amazing story. So, so important to share your idea and get feedback. How did you meet the first two co-founders, so to speak, where you were already working on the idea and evaluating?
They were studying in my university town. We all had an interest to applying our knowledge, to applying what we learned in university into real life. So we met at an event. There was a student consultancy. And they had a kind of an info event for new joiners. So we were there, we met, we got to know each other, and then realized this organization sucks. They are, they are not like, we realized that we all thought like student consultancy is cool. And it's something where, you can apply your knowledge, earn some money. But the way that it was done, the people were not inspiring. The way they did it, it felt like they don't have actual projects. They didn't work with companies. They just kept themselves busy with internal work and patted themselves on the back that they are a student consultancy. So we realized, I think, over a beer that we had the same thoughts. And then from there, realized or said like, well, then let's do it on our, let's do a new one on our own and at our terms and make it better. And that's, I mean, I think we've seen each other before at parties and knew each other a little bit, but this was the moment where we really got together and said, let's do something together. And that's how this relationship formed.
That's amazing. So university is a great breeding ground to find your potential co-founders. What then made you or makes you a great team, the four co-founders of you? How did you sort of like split and bring together the things that a good, strong team needs?
Yeah. So like, let me start from the end. We're not four co-founders in the company anymore. So eventually one left and another left. So it's like a marriage, sometimes it works until the end. Sometimes there are divorces, which is normal. It's like any relationship. But in the beginning, what brought us together was our passion of doing stuff, of being entrepreneurs. That was a strong glue. And then we had very, a lot of good synergies. I was strong at things where the others weren't strong and then the other way around. So we had a pretty complementary skill set and so naturally things fell into place where naturally my co-founders would do certain things, I would do certain things, and then it fit very well together. I think that's what I observed a lot of times. It starts naturally. You like each other. You see, you have complementary skill set, then you start doing. Eventually, as you start the company, as things professionalize, you need to then do things sometimes more consciously. Or then you learn, do we have the right style in, do we have the right values? Do we want to instill the right the same values in the company? Do we have the right same leadership style, same expectations towards each other, et cetera? I think there's a lot of deep stuff that you don't talk about when you just work together in a student-like project. But it's important to early on then also talk about the deep stuff and see, how do we want to run this business? How do we, are we happy with dividing, responsibilities like this right now, like it happened organically, or will this become a problem because you want to do something else or I want to do something else? And I think that's what probably a lot of founders don't do early on, because it's sometimes tough conversations and it's just easier to go on because it feels good. But it needs to happen eventually to professionalize that relationship, that, go from a friendship to also a professional relationship where you can have the courageous conversations that are necessary.
Absolutely. What did that exactly mean in your case? Did you then have like an agreement that you like all signed and said, hey, this is how we want to work, or this is how we share and split things? Or how did this conversation end?
we naturally gravitated to different fields. So I was always interested in organizing things, in marketing. I brought the first contacts with investors. So I was naturally then the CEO, plus took care of marketing. One of my co-founders were very creative and product guy. So he happened to work for KPMG for a while. So he got finance and product. Then the technical co-founder got all the engineering stuff. And my fourth co-founder was really a content focused guy. So he led our content efforts, and then eventually also developed a strong passion for organization, culture. So then he did a lot there. So initially this was just, it was a natural good fit where, you know, everyone was passionate about something, and there was no one said there were not two people who said, I want to do marketing. Now we need to agree who does marketing. So that happened naturally. I think when the challenges that developed eventually were more on the value side, where we really realized after 2 years in, we just did our thing. And then we realized that certain things, we had different opinions of how we should do things, what values are important to us, what values do you want to instill in the company, how much do we want to work, or how much do we want to also do other things, etc. So there. And then we had some coaching sessions or therapy sessions together to try to figure that out.
I love that. So you also then got the external support to break through these questions.
Which I think is very important. I think it's very tough to do this alone. And there are a lot of good coaches, mediators, facilitators who can help couples. I mean, it's also the same with couples therapy, right? Who can help people who are in a relationship, in a professional or a private relationship, to have the conversations that are necessary in a way that is non-violent. If you have it yourself, then emotion gets, you know, part of it, and then you start fighting, and then you go down a negative spiral. And it's very important to have a person in the room who can make sure that this goes into a positive spiral instead.
You mentioned a really important word, non-violent communication, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure you're referring to the book there. Amazing. Very, very recommended in all ways of life, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. And I recommend to start with the Blinks, but also the full book is obviously very good.
100%. So you then actually launched in 2012 officially. And I wonder, you know, you said you were talking to your target group, to investors, but how do you then go about taking, you know, the first initial positive feedbacks to actually, okay, now we really validate the idea to see that we are really building something, not just for ourselves because it's our own problem, but for a market that exists and wants what we're building. How did that validation happen?
First, we did it all wrong. We took our idea, we had our vision that was very complex, not just, you know, you can discover Blinks and then read them. But we thought also how to organize your knowledge. We thought of knowledge graphs and lots of complex stuff. And then we had this really big idea and said, let's build it. It needs to be big and it needs to be whole to launch it, because otherwise it's not complete. So we tried to launch this really big thing, involved a designer who then got crazy how we could design it also with really fancy animations, et cetera, et cetera. And then 3 months in, when we had all these designs and started to code, there was an event in Berlin that a company would invite people that you could show your prototypes to get early feedback. So it probably took us 3 months to do the first proper prototype testing, you know, letting people click through click dummies that we back then did with PowerPoint, because there was no tool for it. So we did a PowerPoint with links so they could click through it. And then we realized that people thought we are a video app and not a reading app, because it was way too visual, way too and also people don't want all these functions. They want to discover titles, then they want to read them, and they want to organize them somewhere in a library. And then we tuned it all back to, then we really found our MVP, and then also learned we need to talk to users frequently as we built. And so, yeah, I got better over time with that, to really think what's, if we have an hypothesis, what's the MVP we can build here to the real MVP. And I think I think the real MVP for Blinkist would have been an email list where you can subscribe to. Maybe you pay €2 a month or like low price point, and we send you a PDF every week or twice a week or whatever. That would have helped us to get the first 1,000 early adopters with very low cost structure and to learn who's interested in that, and then to have a couple of hundred or thousand people who are willing to pay for it, and then ask them, okay, now we want to build an app. What's important to you in an app? And that would have helped us to go to market faster with much less investment and learn faster. But we wanted the app from the start. And so we invested a lot. It took us long to go to market, and then took us 1.5. Like, we started in June 2012. I think we've reached product market fit 2 years later. So until then, until summer 2014, it was still, or probably even end of 2014, we were stagnating at a very low level. Had to raise 2 bridge rounds to be able to continue. So we're always close to bankruptcy, and it was really hard to find investors because we hadn't proven anything. We already burned a lot of money, but we had not found a scalable system yet. And yeah, well, in hindsight, you're always smarter. It got us where we are today, so it's okay.
Absolutely. At the same time, these 2 years that you mentioned, 2.5 years, that also sounds like that was quite an intense period, right? I assume you put in a lot of work and also money into building an amazing product, but you didn't build the traction that investors wanted to see or that you as founders wanted to see. What kept you going in these 2.5 years to not say, let's give it up, this is not working, we do something else, or we go back to our jobs?
So let me first say, everything is an intense period. If you think like, or if anyone who wants to start a business thinks, okay, I need to get through that first phase, and once I have product market fit, things will be easy. No, they won't. Small companies, small problems, big companies, big problems. That's what they say, and that's true. And in my experience, at least. So what kept us going? It was fun. It was really, it felt like a continuation of our university life. We were, you know, working hard, partying. So we were, you know, getting in the office at 9 or 8:30, working hard. Eventually at 6 p.m., opened the first beer, continued to work, had dinner at office. So it was really a blend of this job was our life. And we were all passionate about it. We loved it. So it was just fun. It was, of course, sometimes we thought, oh, damn, maybe, you know, next month we have no money anymore. How do we do it? So there were obviously some sleepless nights, but we also felt like, what's the worst case? The worst case is we don't succeed, and then we start a new company, or we go back to a corporate player. We knew that we are learning a lot through this, so our employability will be better. I think being an entrepreneur is the new strategy consultant. Back then, people went into consulting or investment banking to have a kind of an on-the-job MBA or whatever, and then they eventually they joined bigger companies. We thought back then, well, you know, worst case is we have our entrepreneurship MBA here, and then we find another job if we need the money, or we find another idea and start it again. We are really privileged that we could not fall very deeply, because we always knew if this goes south, we'll find another job and it's not the end of the world. So I think that's why it was not as, didn't feel as heavy. And maybe I'm just ideal, you know, it's 8 years ago. Maybe I'm saying it right now because it's so long ago, but I really feel like I did never feel like, oh damn, my life depends on it.
Yeah, I think that seems to be a healthy way, you know, to take the pressure out of it.
It's a privileged way, right? Not everyone can say that. There are a lot of people that have financially, you know, not the, I mean, it's also not that like, we weren't coming from rich families, and but our families would have been able to support us for a couple of months to give us the time to find another job. So it was always, we had a safety net and the confidence that we will find a job very quickly. And that's a privilege that not everyone has.
Yeah, fully agree. So I also want to talk about Blinkist itself. I know most of the listeners exactly know what you are doing, but just for someone who has never heard of Blinkist before, can you quickly explain how it works, both from the consumer's end, but also from the content production end?
Sure. So, if you want to fit more learning into your daily routines, if you want to read more books, but you don't find the time, you can use Blinkist to do exactly that. We take books, or we take long form content, mostly nonfiction books, but also podcasts, articles. We blink them. That means we distill the key insights into 15-minute reads or listens. So you can either read that or listen to it, provide all of that via an app. So you can download us on iOS, Android. Discover, tell us your interests, and we recommend stuff for you. But you can also search for the stuff you like. Then you start to read or listen, and when you're waiting for the bus. Time that, people now listen to podcasts or listen to radio, a lot of our customers then fill that time or part of that time with Blinkist to stay on top of things, to grow personally, professionally, to broaden their horizon, to just instill their curiosity, basically. So that's what we do for consumers. That's available for consumers, also for companies, to give it to their employees as a corporate learning tool. From a content creation perspective, we do have an editorial team who finds the right content, the right titles that are interesting, that are on bestseller lists, etc. We read them. We take the key insights out of them. That's a pool of experts, of freelance experts that do that. And then we create nice pieces of content in both text and audio. So it's a very well-oiled but manual process that is now increasingly supported by AI. So with, the advances of Gen AI these days, we can, in parts of this process that was purely manual in the early years, or in most of the time, there's now also AI support. But there's still humans that ultimately read the book, and then humans. AI is not as advanced yet to just take a 500-page book and spill out a summary that makes sense.
So AI has a supportive function, so to
right.
speak.
Absolutely.
But one question that comes to mind here with the 15-minute concept, right? There are some books, it seems, that are, so big or so knowledgeable that it's really, really difficult to condense them into a 15-minute summary. Does your team often run into this challenge or this problem?
So our objective is not to perfectly summarize a book. It's not, not possible, because you can't transport in 15 minutes what a book transports in 10 hours. You need to. So it's not about providing a perfectly comprehensive summary. It's about providing some nuggets of key insights that spark your curiosity, that teach you something. So that it should never just be an advertisement. It should give you food for thought and teach you something, and give you the ability to put some of that into action or have a story to tell, whatever the, depending on the topic. Then we see a lot of our customers use Blinkist as a discovery tool. So they read a blink, and then they find the topic so interesting, and they had so much food for thought that they then continue and buy the full book. And that's what it's about. So of course there are books, Thinking Fast and Slow, that have much more meat than others. And we are not dogmatically holding on to those 15 minutes, or sometimes it's also 25 minutes. So then we put more key insights into a blink for Thinking Fast and Slow. But even that, even if we extend to 25 minutes, it's still not a perfectly comprehensive summary. But that's not what we sell, and that's not the intent.
Got it. And from the usage, just out of curiosity, is it more common that people say, hey, I just want to have, some key nuggets, some key points and the inspiration from it? Or then I don't read the book? Or is it more that, hey, I want to discover and then I go ahead and read the full book? Do you know what is a more common use case? Yeah,
the majority of our users are also book lovers. So I would say 2/3 are also people who do read or listen to full books. And then they use Blinkist complementary to it. You know, for some topics, they really use us to discover what book should I read. But then they may be interested, random example, they may be interested in history, but not enough to spend 10 hours on a book. So, and there are certain categories where I say, I want to get some food for thought, some, you know, so some broaden my horizons a little bit, and Blinks are enough for that. And then other topics, I want to go deep, and then Blinks are a discovery topic. This is a discovery format for me. So we see a lot of users who use us in both ways, depending on the category. But then there's also probably then 1/3 of users who claim they do not read or listen to full-length books anymore. They get their information, their learning from YouTube, from podcasts, from TikTok, and from Blinkist. So they use us as one part of, one aspect of their information diet, and books are not part of that.
Right. So you basically solve two very interesting problems, right? You save the time problem. So you help people save a good amount of time in case of the 1/3 that they don't have or want to read the full book. And for the others, you help to make them better decisions to set the right focus for the next book or the next learning experience.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not so much about saving time, because I believe all of us spend a similar amount of time on learning, ultimately. But we have very different patterns. Some read books, some, you know, watch YouTube videos, others read a lot of articles online. I mean, saving time, we can use that in our advertising. It's a strong claim because everyone wants to save time. But in reality, you never save time. You just fill your existing time with different formats. And we can provide a format that is interesting to a lot of people. It gives them a good amount of knowledge density in less time.
Let's also talk about the business side. How does your business model work? You have a freemium and the premium version, also some affiliate links, I think. So how does the business model work?
So we do, we're a subscription model. So if you want to have full access to our library, you have to pay for it because it's, as I said, there are a lot of people working on that content. So we have to obviously fund that somehow. And there's a free model. If you do not want to pay for it, but still want to read a little bit, there's one free blink of the day. So we create one blink per day. So if you open the app, you will always find a blink that you can read or listen to for free. And if you want to have full access or pick the ones that you can read, then you need to pay. We do have affiliate link, like when you're interested in a book and you want to buy it in full, there is an Amazon link. But the truth is, very few people click that Amazon link. Even though a lot of people use Blinkist as a discovery tool, but then you don't have a pattern. When you read a blink and found it interesting, then you don't go back to the app and say, where's the Amazon link I want to click here? You just go to Amazon.com or to the app or to your favorite books or wherever you buy books. You have a habit, a pattern, how to buy books. And people just use that pattern. So no one is looking for a link on Blinkist to purchase. So this is not a meaningful revenue stream for us. It's a subscription model is the core revenue stream, and that's the business model.
And the interesting part is we know that from a B2C market subscription, basically I as a private person can buy the premium subscription, but you also offer that for business and for enterprises. Yeah. How is that split for you? Which revenue side is more important for you?
We were focused on consumer for the most time in the past 11 years. So this is the dominating revenue pool. But the B2B revenue pool is growing at much higher rates. It's a lower base at the moment, but we started to focus on it 2 years ago, and it's growing at still three-digit rates year over year because there's a lot of interest from companies. But we needed to learn how to set up a sales force, how to be a B2B business, basically. So I think in terms of future value generation and scale, B2B will become increasingly important for us.
It's very, very interesting, you know, sort of additional revenue stream that you're building up there. I think that's, yeah, super, super interesting. Going back to the B2C case, how do you actually acquire a new user? It seems to be quite a marketing-heavy acquisition that you have to perform, right, in a B2C space.
Yeah, we do. You know, we are on all the platforms that you would assume. So Facebook, Instagram, Outbrain, Taboola. We do a lot of content marketing, a little bit of TikTok, podcast, influencer, Google, the Google universe. So we have a pretty diverse paid marketing program. We're also building up an SEO program. We have a lot of content. A lot of people search for books, for topics. So that's something we're increasingly tapping into to also build a more organic user acquisition program. And then there is word of mouth. I mean, the people, we have a natural habit to talk about things we've read. And so the more we can get people to use the app, the more opportunities we create for people talking about us or talking about the content they and the insights they gain from Blinkist. And then they will also say, well, I got it from Blinkist, check it out.
That's it. Yeah, that's very cool. Natural word of mouth to bring in more users. Then one thing that once you have a user that I think can be a big challenge is the retention, right? They sign up to Blinkist, maybe they listen to 2-3 Blinkist or even more. How do you then make sure that you actually retain them after signing up? That seems to be almost an equally big challenge.
It's like everyone is fighting for attention. Lots of apps, lots of services. Our competitors in that regard are Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Spotify, podcasts. A lot of big brands or formats and services, a lot of habits that we need to compete against to also claim our share of ear of users. So I believe like we do a lot of things. First, we try to understand the user as soon as possible. So whenever you open the app, you get something relevant, because if you open the app 3 times and you don't see anything that is interesting, then you lose that pattern. You don't open the app anymore. So understanding the user and improving our discovery feed to make sure time to finding something interesting is very short in any session. That's a core lever we're seeing. We use CRM, you know, email push notifications to remind users, but then also you can't just remind them, hey, we're Blinkist, we're still there, come back. You also there, again, you need to send interesting content that is relevant at the right time to provide an incentive for people to get back. So these are things. And then we try to make our content better frequently. Like the more, if you read something, if you spend 15 minutes on Blinkist and you walk away with an aha moment, with a cool insight, then the likelihood that you come back is much higher than if you spend 15 minutes and can't remember anything. So these are the levers we're seeing. We're also increasingly, there's a cool feature called Spaces where you can invite friends or colleagues into a space, like a digital book club, if you will. So that's something we're seeing. It's getting used more and more, and people who are in a space are more engaged, because then you have that social element. If I get a recommendation from Blinkist, that's less powerful than getting a recommendation from a person I know and trust, because I know if that person recommends a title to me, it's probably relevant to me, and I want to also feel some social accountability. Then that person may ask me eventually what I would have thought of it, so I want to read it. Also just to be able to talk about it with that person.
Nice. And how do you find out what is relevant for a person? That sounds like a very data-driven approach to understand.
Absolutely. It's pretty simple. We ask people what they're interested in first. So we try to get some data, some first-party data, what you're interested in. And then we see your usage. We see what you're actually reading, what you finish reading or what you stop reading, etc. And then we feed all that into an algorithm, into a black box with machine learning to figure out what is the next thing we should recommend to you. That's what we're currently doing. We're also thinking of ways, can we tap into external data? You know, there's a lot of, we only capture a very small share of your learning. But if we knew which articles you're reading, which podcasts you're listening to, if we knew all that, we could build a much better profile to deliver you better recommendations. So there are thoughts, how can we learn more about what you're doing outside of Blinkist to give you even better recommendations.
Nice. So it's all about strong content, but then also making things meaningful or relevant for you in that moment?
Relevance is the keyword.
Let's also talk about the funding. You mentioned that, you know, early on you had the investors on board and you then actually built traction in the first two and a half years. In total, I think you raised more than $34 million in five funding rounds. What was more important for you, you know, looking back at these years, successful fundraising in terms of really fueling the growth or steady profitability?
I'd say both. I mean, in the beginning, in the, you know, before we raised our Series B, we never had a chance to be profitable because we, the business model, you know, because we choose to start an app, we had to create content. So we had some cost factors that we could not just make go away. So, and we knew we need to reach a certain scale to be able to fund the minimum, headcount that we need to run this business. So early on, it was all about growth and raising funds. So no one asked us for, can you be profitable in 6 months? People wanted to know, understand, how can this be profitable, you know, at scale? And that's what, you know, you can model that easily. So in the early years, it was more about staying frugal to keep burn rate low. So we can, with the funds we raise, we can get go as long as possible. But it was never about profitability, but all about growth, because that's what early stage investors want to see is the market big enough and are people interested in it. And then eventually after a Series B, we realized that it at scale, it gets harder to grow. You have some churn, but you need to make up for that churn and then grow on top. It gets more expensive to grow. CACs, customer acquisition costs rise. So we thought we may get into a situation where growth investors that would invest in their CD eventually think like this gets too expensive, and then we would need to accept terms that we do not want to accept. So then we said, now we have the ability, just logically, we can run this company in a way that is cash efficient, that is break even. So we can be in charge of our own destiny, and that felt good. As I described earlier, in the early years we had phases where we were not in charge of our own destiny and we were really relying on new funding. So there were situations where we felt like in 2 months we were running out of money and we do not have funding yet. So and it was really last minute, we had two last minute situations with funding rounds, and when we then at later stage had the chance to become in charge of our own destiny, we took it and said, let's run this company at break even and still grow, but don't grow too aggressively, because we don't know whether or at which terms we would get funding to fund that growth at all costs. And it's also not a winner. We're not in a winner takes it all market. So we did not have the incentive to say we need to capture market share as soon as possible to win.
One thing you said stuck out as counterintuitive from my outside perspective. You said the customer acquisition costs get more and more expensive the bigger you grow. Is that because you have some low-hanging fruit, so to say, people who are really, you know, looking for a solution like Blinkist? Once they have it, you have them in your user base, and then to grow further, it gets more and more difficult to find new users. Is that the case?
It's usually the case. I hear from also most investors told us, as you grow, your customer acquisition costs will become more expensive, because obviously early on you market in the cheapest channels and you market to your early adopter audience, but eventually you want to get out of that niche and build a mainstream product. And building a mainstream product requires to do more brand awareness, you know, than users. You know, there are a certain set of users for any brand that you explain it in a minute and they say that I've been looking for that and I'll buy it right away. But eventually you get into an audience, into the late majority that needs more education, that needs to hear about you seven times and needs to be educated more. And then eventually you said, yeah, now I've heard about it from here, I've heard about it from there. There has to be something to it. I'll give it a try. And so that requires just more marketing touch points, and more marketing touch points means more marketing budget. So it's a I think with a lot of companies, it's the same. The rule of thumb, as you scale, your CACs get higher.
Yeah, I think that's important to, you know, keep in mind as an early stage founder when we build our financial models, because I see many founders, they say, well, now it's a bit expensive, but later it will get cheaper. But it's actually the other way around. And that's very important to keep in mind.
There's probably also, you know, I mean, depending on how early you are, sometimes you have not cracked the code yet on how to run our advertising on Facebook. You need a certain scale to train the algorithms. You need a certain team to do funnel optimization to improve conversion rates. So usually you actually do see that your CACs are getting lower as you get smarter about conversion optimization, how to manage a funnel. But then eventually, once you have a well-oiled machine and then you want to scale further, then it goes up again.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that. I think that's super helpful insights. I have one last very important topic to talk about to you. What happened in 2023? You were acquired by the Australian content company GoOne. So please tell us a bit more about that, why you decided to sell and why that was the right partner for you.
Yeah. So, I mean, the minute we took venture capital in early on, we knew eventually there is an exit because venture capital wants to sell eventually, whether that's through an IPO or through a trade sale. These are the two options. So selling the company eventually was always built in. There was no pressure from our board. Like everyone was still happy and we grew. But we also, I mean, we've been around for 11 years and we knew that eventually the first funds will knock on our doors and say, okay, how do you think about selling eventually? So in the past years, my job also became to build relationships with companies that could potentially buy us eventually and to see what, you know, test the waters here and there. It was just part of my job. GoOne was a company I knew since 4 years. You know, I frequently traded notes with Andrew, the CEO and founder. We got along. We had a lot of very good chemistry between us. We knew there's a lot of synergies. They were strong in B2B. We had a strong product and content and a consumer brand. And we always sometimes jokingly said, look, you know, if we were one company, we could do so many things together. And then eventually last year they switched from joking about it to say let's seriously talk about it, because they raised a good round, had money and had also the plan to grow also inorganically, like to grow through acquisitions. And they were looking for a strong consumer brand that could help feed the funnel into B2B better. They were looking for new products to sell through their sales force. So eventually, yeah, we met to think about how could that look like. So we said let's do a two day workshop among the founders to see is there a fit, is there a personal fit, is there a fit in vision, etc. And that checked a lot of boxes. I think both sides walked away from it saying like this could work. And then we decided to start into a process and negotiate it. They did due diligence, everything you do. And it felt, why did we sell? I think it's a rare opportunity to find such a good fit that is both from a business perspective a good fit that has a lot of synergies. So we did not need to lay off any people here. Like it was not like, okay, we acquire you and then we can get rid of 50% of our workforce. But it was really synergetic. So finding something with such a strong synergy, with such a strong fit in terms of vision, with such a strong personal fit is very rare. And then I thought, do I wait another 2 or 3 years to try to get a better price because we grow? Maybe, but then maybe not. And maybe then we have to sell to a company that is not as good of a fit. So it was ultimately an easy decision for me as a founder, but also for our board. I mean, not an easy, you know, you always negotiate and you also want a higher price and they want a lower price. That's the usual dance.
That's the game.
It was a good fit. And we said that it makes sense to do this now.
So this seems to make a ton of sense from a strategic perspective, right? Strong B2C brand worldwide, strong B2B sales team. You combine the two and you have a really good leverage. How did you arrive at the price?
Yeah. that's pure negotiation. You look at multiples, you know, you, like the buyer, like both sides look at multiples. What are other companies in that sector worth? What's revenue multiples, EBITDA multiples? You look at strategic synergies, that they'd also play a role. And then eventually one side, in this case, the acquirer, you know, starts with a price, starts with an offer. They need to send a term sheet, right? And then you send a red line of that term sheet back, and then you go back and forth. But yeah.
I have to ask, it's my job as a podcast host. How much did you sell it for?
We do not comment on that. That's what we agreed on with the buyer. But it was a good price that made everyone happy.
Okay, that's a good hint that the investors were happy and everyone was happy.
Yeah.
So now also, of course, after the acquisition, you know, what is next for you? Do you plan to stay on board for a longer time? What is the plan for you?
Yeah, I plan to stay on board. I mean, I'm now no longer the CEO of Blinkist. I'm now COO Learners at Go One. So we are an organization now that focus on the learner. So that still is predominantly growing Blinkist, but also, you know, Go One has products or that have learner-facing elements, and we can use our consumer experience to improve those things. So we want to get rid of the thinking we are Blinkist, you're Go One. We are all Go One now, and we have learners, consumers as a person that is interested, a stakeholder. We have employers, organizations as stakeholder, and we also have creators, content creators as a stakeholder. These are the three stakeholders, and we are organizing the org principle is focused on these three stakeholders, and I focus on the learner together with my team here, the former Blinkist team. And that's a lot of fun. We have big ambitions, big opportunity ahead, and I'm not done here. So I'll stay on board and have work to do.
And how was it for you as a founder and sort of the face of Blinkist also as the CEO, you know, to sort of sell your baby to a certain degree? What was that? An easy process, or was it also a bit emotionally challenging to let go and find a new home, basically?
It was something in between. It's never easy. You never know what are you getting into, and it feels like it's things will change and you no longer have full control over it. So you need to let go. And at the same time, it was not emotionally. I'm a pretty pragmatic guy, so I'm wired like that. And I thought, like, we always knew an exit is inevitable, also mm-hmm. desired. And I thought this is a great fit. Like, it checks so many boxes. So that made it easy, or relatively easy. I think. And then you sell, and then you get into the first integration, and you feel like, oh, damn, this feels different. Now I don't have as much autonomy anymore as before, because they are micromanagers or tell us what to do, but just because you have to work in a broader, big organization. There are new stakeholders, mm-hmm. new interdependencies, new things you have to take into account. This is so as everyone here at Blinkist, we go through a change process now that at times has, you know, there are hours that feel discomfort, you know, that feel like, oh, damn, this really changes now. But it's all good. It's nothing like, I think I will say to every entrepreneur, don't underestimate a post-merger integration. It is work. It needs proper change management, and it's a full-time job. And even if a lot of things align, like in our case, it's still a lot of work. And that's also what investors tell me who see that every year. But it's another, you know, I love it. I learn so much. I learn so many new aspects now. Like in a year from now, I can say I also been there, done this, which is great.
Amazing. Holger, to wrap up today's episode, I also have some rapid fire questions for you. So I give you a short question and you can answer in one sentence.
Okay, cool.
You ready?
Of course.
What was the last Blink that you listened to?
Stonewall, a story of LGBTQ rights. It's about this Christopher Street in New York and a pub there.
Great. Are you more of an early bird or a night owl?
Early bird. More so even with my two kids now. But have always been an early bird.
Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Do you have a favorite Blink of all time?
That's a tough one. Probably Drunk. Drunk by Edward Slingeland. Tells a story of why do people get drunk.
I will check that out afterwards. Yeah. Do you still read books the old-fashioned way, or you really focus on Blinks and digital ways?
I do read long form a lot, both fiction and non-fiction, but through a Kindle. I don't know whether that counts as old-fashioned.
Probably soon, you know, as things rapidly changed. Microsoft, Google, or Apple?
Apple.
Clear choice. And the last one for you. What's one change that you made in your life as a result of listening to a Blink?
I'm a big fan of Mindset from Carol Dweck, which I first discovered as a Blink, but then also read as a full book. And I think that book taught me a lot about where I may have a static mindset. So that made me more aware of my mindset and when I have a static or fixed mindset versus a growth mindset. And it helped me to increase awareness and adopt a growth mindset more often.
Amazing. Holger, thank you so much for coming on the show and for your open and great stories that you shared today. Lots of success with the integration and all the best for you. Thank you again for coming on the
show. Thanks for having me, Sylvain. Have a good one.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, you can support us by rating our show on Apple Podcasts. This way, we can reach an ever-growing number of aspiring entrepreneurs.